My guest this week is Marie Ashe. She is a constitutional law and religion professor at Suffolk University Law School in Boston. And today we're going to talk about the religious freedom wars and the trajectory of Supreme Court jurisprudence on religious freedom and the separation of church and state, and also how that has impacted freedom and civil rights for women. And I'm drawing quite a bit on Marie, your two articles that you wrote on religious freedom in the United States and women's rights. And I want to contrast two historical events that, one of which you wrote in detail about and one which is in the news quite a bit in 2012. And I'm going to be cycling back several hundred years and ask you to talk about someone who's a hero to conservatives, contemporary American conservatives, John Winthrop, who was governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and is revered by conservatives for talking about America as the shining city on the hill. And in 1638, he deemed Anne Hutchinson a heretic, someone who was very promiscuous and someone who gives birth to monsters. And he presided over a trial of Anne Winthrop, which resulted in her being expelled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Fast forward to 2012, and we have a conservative hero, Rush Limbaugh, pronouncing Georgetown law student Sandra Fluck a slut. So why do we still hear the echoes of this colonial Puritanism in contemporary American political discourse and even in legal doctrine? That's what we're going to be talking about. And so Marie wrote in detail about Anne Hutchinson's trial. And I think that, you know, she's seen as a heroine to contemporary feminists. And she's also seen as a heroine of religious freedom. But her religious freedom was actually... Well, why don't you talk about it?
Okay. And as I listened to your introduction, Sarah, I've heard lots of ands, and it sounds like we're going to be talking about a lot of issues over a long period of time in a limited amount of time. So just to begin, I just want to mention that, you know, certainly locals in Boston and many travelers to Boston are familiar with the Massachusetts State House at the top of Beacon Hill. Mm-hmm. And many of them are also familiar with the tourist route that is mapped out through downtown Boston, and that is called the Freedom Trail. Those who've walked along that trail have passed by the front door of the State House and have seen on either side of that front door monuments to two women, Anne Hutchinson, whom you've already identified, who was exiled from the Bay Colony in 1638, and the plaque on the monument to her defines her as an exponent of civil liberty and of religious toleration. Right. On the other side of the State House door, there is a statue to Anne Hutchinson, memorializing Anne Hutchinson's friend, Mary Dyer, who was hanged on the Boston Common in 1860. And the engraving on that statue says that Mary Dyer was a witness for religious freedom. And as you've already indicated in your remarks, their stories are actually quite complex, and neither of them enjoyed religious freedom in the Bay Colony.
Well, I think that the statute suggests that she was a martyr in the sense that her freedom of religion, she was considered a heretic of sorts, not only because she questioned male clerical authority, she deigned to go hear male clerical authorities preach and take notes on what they were saying, and then have discussions in her own home, in the privacy of her own home, about those sermons and about that preaching and questioning the theology of the ruling religious authorities. And she left England and came to the colonies because, again, because of religious freedom issues or you know, an issue around her ability to discuss these religious issues publicly. But there's, you know, there's more to what the State House statue of Anne Hutchinson depicts, because it's not just that she was questioning the religious authorities. It's also that as a woman, that they took particular offense to how a woman was questioning the religious authorities.
That's right. That's very true. The Anne Hutchinson became a major figure, certainly the most well-known figure in a huge controversy, a conflict, a struggle about political power that occurred in the Massachusetts Bay Colony at the end of the 1630s. And it was a political struggle that was attached to a theological controversy, a theological dispute. But the stakes were actually extremely high in that what was going to be determined by the resolution of this conflict was who would control the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who would hold the political power. So, you know, we all know that the settlers of the Bay Colony were dissidents to the Church of England. Right. They were people who felt that the Church of England had not been sufficiently pure in its separation from the Roman Catholic Church. And the dissidents, while they came, seeking religious liberty, were not interested in religious liberty for people who didn't share their what we could maybe call their orthodox dissidents. And Anne Hutchinson and the clerics with whom she was associated differed from the orthodox Calvinism that was expressed by John Winthrop, who was the governor of Massachusetts, and by almost all of the clerics in the Bay Colony at the time.
So, in a lot of your writings, you in one of the articles that you wrote, you described the trial of Anne Hutchinson, where her privacy and the details of her work as a midwife and her own child rearing or childbearing came into question during her trial. And you describe that case, and then fast forward several centuries, and the Carhart case, the Supreme Court's decision in the late-term abortion ban. You describe those as bookends, which tell us a lot about the trajectory from the questions about women and religion in colonial America and today.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll talk a little bit about Anne Hutchinson's trials and some of the events that followed the trials. But to sort of structure what we'll be talking about, Sarah, I have found the history of what came to be called the antinomian controversy in the Bay Colony to be really fascinating in its own right, for all of the reasons that you've identified: its treatment of women, its treatment of religious dissidents within the dissident community. And I've also found that what I've seen and learned there resonates with current historical developments. I've looked particularly at the Supreme Court's most recent abortion decision, but I have been thinking about the events of the time in connection with the Health and Human Services contraception mandate, et cetera. But as I lead into that, maybe I can just identify a few of the issues and the themes that I see as operating way back in the Massachusetts Bay Colony at the very beginning of an American national narrative that we tell ourselves and that I see as operating at the present time. So I've thought about various issues in both contexts. First of all, I thought very much about the nature of the church-state relationship as it existed back in the Bay Colony and as it existed now, so in a pre-constitutional period and in the 21st century. And I've seen a lot of commonalities there. I've also thought about what the meaning of privacy was back in the 1630s and how privacy has been defined at the present time as a constitutional value protected by the 14th Amendment. And what that meant then and what it means now as applied to women. And I thought about whether there has been a persisting kind of prurience that has been evident in law and in politics at various levels of government, the legislation, in the judicial determinations that affect women and women's bodies and that deny women the protections that are asserted to be provided them as a matter of protection of privacy. And I've thought about whether American law has particularly disfavored and continues to disfavor what we might call antinomian women.
So these are women who question the prevailing religious
Yeah,
orthodoxy?
the orthodoxies and the forms of religious belief that are dictated by religious institutions that to some degree operate in a what could be positively called a cooperative role with civil government, or what could be maybe more negatively called a collusive role in their connection to civil government. So those broad issues are ones that I've looked at, looking back to the 1630s and thinking about the present decade as well.
Right. Now, of course, it's so fascinating because, of course, Anne Hutchinson was born in England not that long after the Reformation. She was born, what, the late 1500s in England. And so this was a time when, during the very tumultuous 16th century in England, people like her were subject to religious persecution because they, the questioning of either the, when a Catholic was in authority, the questioning of the Vatican, or when a Protestant was in authority, questioning of the Church of England. And so there was a lot of heretic hunting on both sides.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And she but she her particular role as a woman in colonial Massachusetts, and also there was a little detail in your piece about her trial, about how they probed her sexuality and her women's reproductive lives because she worked as a midwife, as a dyer, I believe, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and they were the male authorities conducting the trial were essentially taking, it was almost like a Salem witch trial sort of environment where they were accusing her of having birthed monsters and and so forth.
That's correct. And, the just the concepts of privacy operated very, very much in the civil and the church trials of Anne Hutchinson. I've mentioned already that there was a theological controversy, and that sounds like a very abstract consideration, but to put it in simple terms, Anne Hutchinson had come to the Massachusetts Bay with her husband and her 11 surviving children. Had practiced as a midwife in the colony, had followed to the colony a cleric named John Cotton, who was an advocate of what was called free grace, which was a sort of more mystical, more personal, and more prophetic kind of religious approach than the one that was taken by the most of the Calvinist clerics who were already in the Bay Colony. And Cotton fled England because he was about to be thrown into prison there for his beliefs. So Hutchinson came along with him, and these free grace religionists were sometimes called antinomian, with that concept suggests an anti-legalist approach, because they emphasized revelation and insight and vision in a way that was different from the emphasis that was given to good works and moral rules emphasized by the other Calvinists. So you wanted to say something there. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Well, so it's interesting. So I think that, like you said, the statue at the Massachusetts State House indicates Hutchinson being a heroine, not only to feminists, but to people who value religious freedom. And in preparing for today, I was doing a little reading on how contemporary conservatives see Hutchinson. And my colleague Lori Lebo had written a lot about the Texas textbook controversy, the efforts to rewrite the textbook curriculum, the public school curriculum in Texas. And one of the reviewers or the experts consulted on the social studies curriculum believed that students should not learn about Anne Hutchinson along
Oh,
with
that's
William
really
Cowan and
fascinating.
Roger Williams, another proponent of religious freedom and a hero of
Yeah,
people who
and
also believe in religious freedom and the separation of church and state. And what this reviewer, his name is Peter Marshall, said about Hutchinson was, Anne Hutchinson does not belong in the company of these eminent gentlemen.
Oh,
She was
remarkable.
certainly not a significant colonial leader and didn't accomplish anything except getting herself exiled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony for making
For
trouble.
making trouble. Well, she did make trouble, and she did get expelled. But what you say about the textbooks is really fascinating to me. Hold for one second. I wanted just to reach to pull out something that you may not get a great image of this, but let me hold it up here at the screen at any rate. Can you see that at all? Oh, you
Well,
can't
we
see it,
can't see
of
each
course.
other, but
Okay,
when
but
people
what I'm
watch it, they'll
holding
see
up
it.
here is a picture, a drawing from the early 20th century of the trial of Anne Hutchinson. And Anne Hutchinson, this drawing was a depiction that was included in public school textbooks throughout the early part of the 20th century. And it's a very powerful one. It really captures the flavor of the trial where Anne Hutchinson is standing before this body of numerous men, all men, who included the governor of Massachusetts and various elders of the Calvinist Church in Massachusetts, who were members of the Massachusetts legislature. What was called the Great Court of Massachusetts was both a judicial and legislative body at the time. And they were the witnesses against her and the official who would preside at her trial. So she stands before all of them, looking extremely confident, rather assured, and I like the drawing very much because I think it captures so much of how she presented herself at this trial, how she defended herself, talking very much about privacy, by the way, and how isolated she was. It's sort of evocative of the film The Passion of Joan of Arc from the late 1920s from France. And truthfully, we'll get to this later in our conversation, but when I saw Sandra Flock in front of the body of men listening reluctantly to her testimony in Congress, I was reminded of this drawing of Anne Hutchinson.
Well, they actually didn't, they only listened to the Democrats convened a hearing to listen to her
That's
testimony.
right.
The Republicans did not, in the Republican-led hearing, they did not allow her testimony. But she was, there is a photograph of the morning panel of that hearing you're referring to, that had only men on it, and Sandra Fluff is sitting behind them.
You're right, and that is what I'm referring to.
So let's segue to that, because it's you talk a lot about how, so of course in Anne Hutchinson's day there was no separation of church and state. That obviously came later with the drafting of the Constitution. And you write a lot about how the Supreme Court jurisprudence on church state separation has evolved, as has Supreme Court jurisprudence on the Free Exercise Clause, the clause that the proponents the opponents of HHS contraception mandate are invoking, saying that the contraception mandate violates their freedom of religion, violates their right to freely exercise their religion. And you have discussed the trajectory of the court's rulings on that as being in, this is probably an imperfect way of saying it, but in they have increased the protections for religious freedom in an inverse proportion to protecting women's rights. Would that be a fair characterization?
That's a very fair and succinct characterization. Yes, okay. That's exactly right. You know, and I would like to talk about that very much in the context of the current litigation that has been filed by various entities of the Catholic Church and by various states at the present time challenging the contraception mandate. Before we get to that, can we linger for just another few minutes over Anne Hutchinson? Because
yes.
I just want to mention a few things that I think can give us some reason to think concretely about the ways in which maybe we haven't advanced nationally so much as we imagine in terms of religious freedom. So I want to talk just very briefly about the civil trial and about the church trial of Anne Hutchinson. And both of those involved issues about privacy and issues that I've characterized as matters of prurience. In the what happened with Anne Hutchinson is that, as I've indicated, she was part of this antinomian, very much minority group in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. She was a well-educated woman. She was highly literate. And she had the practice, which many of the colonists did and which the Calvinists strongly recommended, of taking notes at the sermons that were delivered by the male clerics in the colony. And this was a practice of the Puritans because it was thought it was desirable for the adults to take notes and then to share, rely on their notes to discuss religion with their children in the privacy of their homes. So Anne Hutchinson took notes and she thought about what she had heard from the clerics. And she began to talk about her own interpretations of texts on which the clerics had commented. And she began to share her thoughts and her commentaries, not just with her immediate family, but with others to whom she invited to come into her home. She had a strong following. She was a very valued and popular presence in the colony because of her midwifing role. So initially she began to have gatherings just of women in her home. Eventually the gatherings came to include men as well. And finally, some of the clerics came as guests to Anne Hutchinson's home to listen to what she was saying, what her interpretations were. And this was where the trouble began because the clerics didn't like what she was saying. Many of her remarks were critical of the sermonizing that was being done by Calvinist clerics who definitely were not sympathetic to the free grace movement. So those clerics reported Anne Hutchinson's comments to the civil and the church authorities. Hutchinson's home was across the road from that of Governor Winthrop, and he didn't like the large numbers of people who were clearly being influenced by what she was saying to them in the privacy of her home. So she was subjected to examinations or trials, first a civil trial and secondly a church trial. And in the civil trial, she defended herself all alone against very vaguely formulated charges, which seemed to reduce to the charge that she had criticized ministers in a way that violated the commandment that she honor her father and her mother, where the ministers were seen as her fathers in a religious and spiritual sense. So Anne Hutchinson relied very much upon a legal concept of privacy that was well recognized in British law and that had been carried over to the Bay Colony, and emphasized that whatever she had said in the privacy of her home and not in some public forum. And Winthrop seemed to acknowledge the weight of that general proposition that statements made in the privacy of one's home shouldn't give rise to public or civil prosecution,
right.
But he while acknowledging or giving a nod to it, essentially chose to ignore it and to go forward with the trial. At the end of Anne Hutchinson's trial, after she had very effectively parried with Governor Winthrop, she, perhaps in a moment of confidence, ventured to do something that would absolutely not be forgiven, in that she began to speak in a very personal way about her own experience of revelation, of vision, of insight, and of moral conviction. And when she did that, she didn't utilize what was a prescribed formula for testifying in what is now recognized as a literary genre, the conversion narrative. She didn't do that. She talked in a much more personal and individual way. And this statement itself was seen as enough to convict her of the failure to honor her fathers and led to her the order of banishment. The civil trial was followed by a church trial, which again found her guilty of heresy and ordered her excommunicated from the church. So Hutchinson, at the end of the two trials, left Massachusetts and went to Rhode Island, where she was welcomed by Roger Williams, who had had his own experiences about which he never ceased to write of religious intolerance in the Massachusetts Bay.
And Roger Williams was a strong proponent of the separation of church and state.
He was a strong, very strong proponent, and he complained bitterly about the fact that while he might properly have been seen as heretical to some degree, that he hadn't warranted a banishment by the civil authority. So he wanted very much to strengthen the concept of separation of church and state, which was just a tiny thread in the discourse of the time, and in practical terms didn't exist in the Bay Colony. Go ahead.
I
just want to finish briefly with the developments of the 1630s and talk a little bit about what you alluded to earlier, Sarah, which was the prurience factor. In the aftermath of both of the, or each of the trials, this question of privacy came up again. And one of the privacies that was particularly protected in British law and in the colonial law was a privacy, as we know, that people shared in their own homes. A man's home is his castle, and a particular privacy that women enjoyed in birthing chambers, in the spaces in which they gave birth. So childbirth was typically an event attended by women only, by the women who were, the woman who was giving birth, and by her midwives, who were also female. And this privacy was violated in an extraordinary way by Governor Winthrop in two ways that followed each one of the trials of Ian Hutchinson. Following the civil trial, Winthrop learned that Anne Hutchinson had been a midwife at the premature delivery of a fetus by her good friend, Mary Dyer. Mm-hmm. And he had heard the rumor that the fetus, which had been delivered, had been, quotes, a monster. And indeed, the fetus had been delivered after 7 months of pregnancy, and it had been highly deformed. Mm-hmm. And Anne Hutchinson and another midwife had attended Dyer's delivery. And when the fetus was delivered, they consulted with one of the clerks, with John Cotton, and said, asked him what they should do with the remains of the fetus. And Cotton said, you should bury the remains. This deformed creature may be a message from God to the parents and perhaps to the midwives, but should be buried quietly and privately. So they did bury the fetus. And when Winthrop learned about all of this in the aftermath of Hutchinson's first trial, he ordered that the fetus should be dug up from the place where it had been buried. And he personally inspected the remains of the fetus. And he wrote a lengthy description, many paragraphs, recording in great detail the characteristics of this, quotes, monstrous and misshapen child. And in Hutchinson's mind, the monstrous nature of the fetus indicated the monstrous nature of the beliefs that were entertained and communicated by Anne Hutchinson, who had attended the delivery of the monstrous child. So John Winthrop, as the governor, testified about the monstrous birth of Mary Dyer, attended by Anne Hutchinson, and he gave that testimony in Hutchinson's church trial. After the church trial, when Hutchinson is excommunicated, banished, and is already living in Rhode Island, Hutchinson had been pregnant during the trial, and she delivered a child in Rhode Island, and the child was a highly deformed fetus, which was delivered in a fragmented condition. Many people later, medical experts, have speculated that the condition of the fetus may have had to do with some with Hutchinson's age and with her gestational history. This was her 15th child. But at any rate, Governor Winthrop contacted the persons who had attended the birth and asked them to describe the fetus delivered by Hutchinson. And they talked about its fragmented nature. Winthrop wrote about this and said that fetus, he said, Anne Hutchinson brought forth not just one monstrous birth in the way that Mary Dyer had, but perhaps 30 monsters, 30 fragments. He described this birth again to indicate the monstrousness of Anne Hutchinson herself, of her body, in association with her sexuality, with her pregnancy, with childbirth. And Winthrop's writing was published widely, both in the colony and in England. It went through multiple publications. Commentators suggested that the 30 fragments corresponded to the 30 heresies with which she had been charged at the church trial. Other writings following the church trial suggested that this monstrosity of her childbirth indicated that Anne Hutchinson and also later Mary Dyer must have been promiscuous themselves. So at this very beginning of the American narrative in the 1630s, we see this entangling of the civil authorities with an orthodox kind of powerful church from whom it never would truly separate. Lots of anxiety about women and their privacies, breaches of the privacies by the civil and the religious law. And, you know, a prurient, very much male gaze, inspection, documentation, recordation that sort of purports to actually be scientific, related to women's bodies and women's childbirths, women's children, women's fetuses.
Right, right.
So enough on the 1500s, maybe.
Yeah, let's move to the 20th and 21st century. I know you've written a little bit about the period in between, but I think, you know, for the sake of what we're discussing, I might skip over some of that.
Okay.
But, you know, it's interesting your thesis about the anxiety about women and their privacy, because what you have during the period, and I know that you in your writing, you've divided these different historical periods or these periods of Supreme Court jurisprudence into particular segments. But for the purposes of our discussion, I want to sort of zero in on the period following Griswold and Eisenstadt and Roe. So those are the line of decisions that recognized the right to privacy and found the criminalization of the use of birth control or the distribution of birth control, as well as in Roe, obviously the criminalization of abortion, to be unconstitutional. And so those were decisions that seemed to, or did, protect, you know, not only recognize, but protect a right of privacy for women in their reproductive and sexual lives.
That's absolutely right. And Roe, in 1973, defined abortion as a fundamental right of liberty, sometimes called a right of privacy, that is protected by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution.
So we had this period moving away from, you know, it's obviously, politically speaking, a period during, you know, the women's movement.
That's right.
And you see this reflection of those social changes in the Supreme Court jurisprudence. And you would think that, you know, obviously, you know, for since 1973, opponents of legal abortion have been fighting Roe, not just in, you know, in efforts to create laws in the state legislatures that would eventually challenge it, but also in the court of public opinion that have greatly impacted the way women's sexual lives are discussed publicly. That, you know, so that you see somebody like Rush Limbaugh calling Sandra Fluke a slut because she, you know, dared to publicly discuss the fact that she has sex with her boyfriend and uses birth control. But in the recent GOP presidential primary, we saw, which I think was shocking to a lot of people, a questioning of the wisdom of Griswold, which was the 1965, right?
That's right.
Decision on contraception. And we saw Rick Santorum publicly questioning Griswold, not just because it was the setup case for Roe, but also because, you know, of an opposition to the use of birth control. And then there's, at the same time, the development of a line of Supreme Court cases which expand? Would that be the right verb to use?
Absolutely. Feel free to use it. And I know that the rhetoric of the religious right is that religious liberty is being eroded. But that certainly is not my reading of constitutional law and of developments of the last 20 years.
Right. So in the last 20 years, the Supreme Court has actually expanded the definition of religious liberty. Do you think it has expanded it enough to find that the HHS contraception mandate violates religious liberty?
Okay.
Do you think that the Catholic organization suing HHS have a case?
Yeah. And in one of the articles that you've read, the one that's called Women's Rights, Religious Wrongs, I do provide a history that looks at interpretations by the Supreme Court of liberty and equality at three different periods in American constitutional history. So I look at what the court has said about liberty and equality as those will be enjoyed by at least the Orthodox religions, and at liberty and equality as those will be only very stingily and begrudgingly recognized as freedoms to be enjoyed by women. So looking at the Health and Human Services, the contraception mandate, and I know you've talked about this in some of your postings already on Religion Dispatches, Sarah. Do you want to maybe summarize the background for that mandate?
Well, so the under the Affordable Care Act, which was the big healthcare reform law that was passed in 2010, the Department of Health and Human Services issued a regulation that requires employers who provide health insurance to their employees to cover contraception free of deductibles and copays. And the proposed final rule exempts explicitly religious organizations like churches and so forth from who employ co-religionists from having to comply with it if they object to if they have a religious objection to the use of contraception. But it doesn't exempt Catholic universities and hospitals and the dioceses that employ people and provide social services to the community. And that those are the organizations that are suing, saying that it violates their religious freedom because it goes against their teaching, the Catholic Church's teaching that one should not use contraception.
Right. And at this point, a number of lawsuits have been filed. A couple by Catholic colleges, one most recently by Notre Dame University, just in the last week or so. And there's also been a case that was filed by a group of six or seven states, as well as some religious organizations, Catholic religious organizations in the state of Nebraska, and a couple of individuals. So the various lawsuits, all differ a little bit from one another in their formulations and their emphases, but they're very similar in relying on constitutional claims and relying very importantly on a statute that was enacted by Congress in 1993 called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about the constitutional claims and the claims that are based on that statute.
Well, I mean, I guess the sort of more the broader question that I have is, do you think that the way the Supreme Court jurisprudence on religious freedom, as it's developed over the past roughly 20 years, do you think that it affords these plaintiffs a viable constitutional claim, setting aside the RFRA claim that
Okay.
I'm making?
In terms of the constitutional claim, to express this pretty simply, what happened in 1990 was that the Supreme Court decided a case called Smith, which raised the question of whether states had to grant exemptions to religious groups for their religious practices, whether the states had to provide exemptions from neutral laws that were generally applicable and that didn't target religion in any particular way, for example, drug control laws. And in the Smith case, the Supreme Court said no, the states don't have to provide those kinds of exemptions. The free exercise clause of the First Amendment doesn't give religious groups an entitlement to exemptions from these kinds of neutral and generally applicable laws. On the other hand, legislatures can grant those exemptions if they want to. And that's why I'm going to want to talk about RFRA at some point, because RFRA was the statute that Congress enacted in response to Smith, saying, well, after Smith, religious freedom isn't being protected enough, so we need a
And I think
statute, and it's going to be RFRA.
that came from both sides. It wasn't
Oh,
just
yes.
conservatives who objected to the decision in Smith. It was on the more liberal side of things. People thought it wasn't protective enough of religious liberty. The case involved people who for whom smoking peyote was an essential part of their religious ceremonial
That's right.
practice, and the court found that they weren't exempted from state laws criminalizing the use of peyote,
That's right. That's right.
essentially. And the decision it was authored by Justice Scalia. Is that
That's
right?
correct. And Justice Scalia noted that he recognized that the decision meant that individuals and religious organizations too would have to vie for themselves, make their own way through the political process, and seek legislative protection if they wanted privileging or heightened protection that the
And so have we seen since Smith an increase in the amount of legislative efforts to get religious exemptions from otherwise generally applicable laws?
Yes, very,
And
very much so.
how
And
much does that
again,
involve how much of that has involved healthcare and conscious objections to things like contraception or dispensing, pharmacists dispensing birth control or emergency contraception or conscience protections for Catholic hospitals that don't want to perform abortions? I mean, how widespread has that been, those sorts of exemptions as they relate to questions about sex and reproduction?
Those have been very widespread, and they have been based at this point, Sarah, not based with confidence on free exercise claims, because they have involved individuals claiming rights of conscience to be free from the general regulations, typically of state law. Instead, they've relied very heavily on state versions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which, as I've already suggested, provide more protection, more heightened protection for religious freedom than was recognized for individuals, even before the Smith case, to some degree modified the law. And you're right. I'm struck by your comment that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, this statute, was supported by a broad, broad coalition of left-wing and right-wing religious organizations, the most liberal to the most conservative. It was sponsored in Congress by Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch, and it was passed with very, very little discussion by an overwhelming majority in Congress. And it's an instance of something that I've seen very much in the last 20, 25 years where When the word religion or the phrase religious freedom is attached to some initiative, there's a really automatic reaction from political figures in the direction of strongly endorsing that measure without thinking about what its implications would be. So getting back to your specific question, there have been a lot of claims for religious freedom. When the Supreme Court first had occasion to look at what Congress had done in RFRA, it said, well, okay, maybe RFRA can apply at the federal level. In other words, maybe the federal government can require that federal law will meet this standard where Congress would have to justify by a compelling interest any kind of burdening of religious freedom. But the Supreme Court said, we don't see any history. And the court here was speaking in 1997. Said, we don't see any history in the last 40 years of any religious discrimination at the state level by state governments. So RFRA doesn't apply at the state level. But when the court said that, in a case called the Burney case in 1997, right, the state governments went into action. So many states enacted their own RFRAs to provide this extremely heightened kind of protection of individuals' religious freedom. And many state courts, even in the absence of that state legislation, said, we interpret our state constitutions as providing that elevated protection. So there have been lots of conscience claims that have been asserted relying on those formulations, and some of them have succeeded. Very typical ones are the ones that are advanced by pharmacists who are unwilling on the basis of their own religious convictions to dispense contraceptive drugs to women who come with prescriptions that they want to have filled.
Right. So you would think that under Griswold, you have the right to go get contraception, or at least you have the right to not have the state regulate you obtaining contraception. So at the same time that
under Griswold, you have the right, and Griswold was the first major case in the line of privacy cases, and it was a sort of limited holding. It said that married couples in the privacy of their bedrooms have a right to use contraceptives. But Griswold was developed through the Eisenstadt case, so that it's, and through Roe. But I think what's happened, I don't want to get away from your questions about the constitutionalism, but I think I do want to just interject that one of the things that's been happening with the tremendous contribution of Supreme Court rulings is that something pretty weird has occurred with regard to the whole doctrine of privacy. It was, as I said, recognized as a fundamental right in Roe v. Wade. Almost 20 years after that, in 1992, the court decided another major abortion case, the Casey case. The controlling opinion was essentially written by a plurality of the justices who included Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy. And it talked very, very much about liberty. That was the theme. The opinion began with the word liberty. It ended with the word liberty. The word liberty was used about 100 times in the course of the plurality opinion. It talked about women's liberty. And in the Casey opinion, Justice Kennedy said about women's liberty, the destiny of the pregnant woman must be shaped to a large extent by her own concept of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society. So it sounded like it was really going to be an opinion about women's liberty. In fact, the Casey opinion didn't overturn Roe v. Wade, but it utterly transformed the meaning of Roe v. Wade. It said abortion's not a fundamental right. Mm-hmm. The state regulations don't have to be subjected to strict scrutiny. Abortion can be regulated from the time of conception. So it really abandoned the trimester model of Roe v. Wade. And drastically slashed the protections of women's privacy that had been put into place by Roe v. Wade. So when I say something weird is happening, what's weird is that we see this rhetoric about privacy and liberty, which Justice Kennedy repeated in his writing in the Lawrence v. Texas case, which struck down the Texas statutes that had targeted homosexual sodomy, criminalizing that conduct. Again, talking about liberty in a transcendent way. But at the same time, we see in the Casey case and dramatically in the most recent abortion ruling of the court, the Carhart decision, 2007, authored by Justice Kennedy, this rhetoric of liberty and privacy accompanied by rhetoric that writes off privacy for women in the places in which abortions are conducted, in which now, under the federal law, doctors can be criminalized, their particular conduct of a particular method of abortion, of pre-viable fetuses,
in the Carhart case,
is to be, surveyed, observed, reported, and can give rise to criminal liability. No privacy whatsoever for women or their doctors in this space in which privacy seems so highly indicated. And no privacy in the sense of protecting the moral decision-making that Justice Kennedy purports to be concerned to protect. In fact, the court in Carhart refuses to even look at what I call an antinomian brief written by religious women who opt for the method of abortion that the court is going to strike down.
This is the amicus brief that was filed by the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Right. And I think that what you're seeing with the increased movement at the state legislative level
The abortion
to,
regulation at the state level, which we've seen so much of in the last 6 months, actually, the
right.
movements for ultrasound scanning,
Right.
these are very, very intrusive, demeaning, humiliating kinds of procedures that are being prescribed. Again, with a construction of the fetus as an independent person, separate from the body of the pregnant woman on whom the fetus
Well,
is utterly dependent and with whom
that's
it's
the
from whom
goal.
it's really inseparable.
That's the goal of, the personhood
Yes.
bills and the proposed federal statute that would grant fetuses equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment. Now, obviously, we don't know yet how these particular regulations would fare at the Supreme Court, how they would fare under Casey, but they, regardless of how they fare at the Supreme Court, they strongly suggest this effort to not only on the local and personal level violate the privacy of women and their choices, but also to change the law to upend the rulings in Griswold and Eisenstadt and
That's
Roe.
right. Absolutely.
And then
Absolutely.
at the same time, as you've documented, the Supreme Court has become more protective of religious liberty as defined in the sense that the state or federal laws should not, that are generally applicable, should not interfere with your religious conscience, really.
Yeah.
It's not an interference with your religious practice, as perhaps the scenario in Smith was. That was potentially an interference with the people's ability to actually engage in this practice of smoking a peyote as part of the ceremony, as part of the religious ceremony. These efforts to define the contraception mandate is more of a, well, this just violates my conscience and this violates my religious teaching. Where would that go if everybody got to object in that way to otherwise generally applicable laws?
Well, Justice Scalia would say that we would have chaos and anarchy,
That's what he said in Smith.
and maybe that's the case. One of the realities that I think is really important when we think about all of these issues at the present time, and when we look historically, I know you've posted recently at Religion Dispatches about the Reformation period, and we can see echoes of that at the present time as well. I think what we have to keep in mind is that what we're looking at when we think about church and state are competing sovereigns who are sometimes cooperative with one another and sometimes in contention with one another. What we're seeing at the present time is a change, and in the last 20 years, is a change from the sort of equilibrium kind of that existed after the period of the Second World War, where we talked about religious pluralism as something that we experienced and valued in American society. We've seen instead a demand by religious organizations for heightened privileging and protection. We've seen a demand for increased funding that, under the earlier jurisprudence would have been seen clearly as violating the Establishment Clause. What's changed in the last 20 years or so is that what we used to call the wall of separation has essentially been demolished, so that there is a flood of funding that is flowing to religious organizations. School vouchers are being tolerated by the Supreme Court. The delivery of social services by religious groups that just ruminate in on the basis of religion and their hiring and that deliver religious messages incident to their delivery of social services. All of that is happening. At the same time, on the free exercise of religious liberty front, what we're seeing are not so much claims by individuals who end up being protected, but claims by organizations. For example, in the decision this spring in the Hosanna Tabor case, we saw an instance of a church school insisting that in its employment relationship with its workers, it wasn't bound by the obligations not to discriminate on the basis of disability that are defined by federal law. And we saw the Supreme Court recognizing a new constitutional entitlement in churches, which it called the ministerial exemption. That means that in relationship to their employers, churches are free to define who their ministers will be and to hire and
Free
fire
themselves from,
those ministers, that those
right,
individuals won't be enjoy protection. I'm sorry.
essentially free themselves from being subject to anti-discrimination
That's right.
laws.
Make themselves exempt from anti-discrimination laws. And this is the thing that's very, very troubling, and that I think comes back to the litigation about the contraception mandates. And I know we're running out of time here, so I'll try to make this brief with just a couple of points. In the litigation, what we're seeing are church-related entities, colleges, hospitals, universities, who are large entities employing, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of workers, many of whom are not Catholics. And we see the contraception mandate as requiring that those churches, which church groups, which, by the way, are recipients of massive federal funding, that they be treated the way other employers are, who are regulable, as, you know, entities operating in commerce in the United States, who can be reached and regulated by Congress, requiring that they deliver broad-based insurance that doesn't exclude contraceptive coverage, and that in fact includes it without copayment as a preventive service for women. So we see these organizations claiming rights of conscience, and we have to ask ourselves, well, does a hospital, does a university, does a college, which essentially is a corporate kind of structure, does it have a conscience? What mm-hmm. about the consciences of the individuals who are affected? You know, just as the religious teacher in the school and Hosanna Tabor had religious interests and conscience determinations, her interests weren't protected. The organizations were protected. But there becomes something troubling and questionable when Notre Dame University talks about its conscience. I mean, what is its conscience? A corporation is not a person unless the
Supreme Court has said it is.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm thinking of Citizens
well,
United.
Yes. And that brings us to the question you asked about the viability of these lawsuits. Mm-hmm. They're really, really stretching. Their constitutional claim that they have one, if they're basing it on the ministerial exemption that was recognized in Hosanna Tabor, doesn't seem to apply at all, because the hundreds and thousands of women who work for colleges, universities, and hospitals that are affiliated with institutionalized religions are not ministers and can't conceivably be characterized as ministerial employees. So that's so much for that constitutional claim. With regard to the RFRA claim, again, and I'll conclude with this, RFRA protects persons from being burdened in their exercise of religious freedom. It doesn't protect organizations. Now, the Notre Dame University says organizations are protected too, but the Supreme Court hasn't really said that, that that's the meaning of RFRA. In fact, an interesting development of the present moment is that Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, who we know is being mentioned as a potential running mate with Mitt Romney, has introduced into Congress what he has called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 2012. And
Super
that
helpful.
Would explicitly exempt not only the hospitals, universities, colleges that are subject to the contraception mandate at this point, but all religious individuals and entities that might conceivably be burdened with such a mandate.
So this includes what the General Counsel for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops once called the Taco Bell rule, that if you're the CEO of a Taco Bell franchise or the manager of a Taco Bell franchise, you should be able to object to the mandate
Absolutely.
On religious grounds.
So, it's a horrifying development. And again, when we think about it in terms of church and state, even apart from the fact that all of this reflect, implicates women's interests in a very concrete and painful and specific way, we see an alteration in an American understanding of who we are and how much freedom we make room for, what we tolerate, and what we will stamp out in the name of mainstream religious orthodoxy. So maybe I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's probably a good but somewhat troubling place to stop. I want to thank you so much for spending the time to talk about all these very complicated issues in such a cogent way.
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me and for your own work on these issues, which are tremendously important and complicated, and which we can't talk enough about.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll talk about it again.
Okay. Thank you again, sir.
Thanks, Marie.
Bye.